You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then, Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now, Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Ch-ch-chumba. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You're listening to Creative Quarantine, and I'm your host, Angelique Roche. We are talking to one of my favorite executive producers, showrunners, and just a really amazing nerd, pop culture fan, and talented TV writer today, Quentin Peoples. You may know his work from The Last Ship, or from Marvel's Runaways, or Flash Forward, or so many other really cool projects out there. And we had a great chat today, which was very fundamental, but also, I would say, just like very insightful on how he's still continuing to work, still continuing to write, and the transition of what it looks like in writers' rooms in LA right now as folks are continuing to social distance. And, you know, it was a really great conversation. Quentin is always such a lovely, lovely person who really enjoys his work. And so I am looking forward to you, particularly if you're a writer or an aspiring writer or a producer or aspiring showrunner, to hear this amazing conversation. All right, we are live. It is, I believe the day is Wednesday.
Yeah, I'll confirm.
Great. It seems like it's been a year of Sundays, but we'll take it. And I am here with the Quentin Peoples. Hello, sir.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. I am really excited. This is kind of a little bit of a dream come true for me because I respect what you do so much. And I'm like,
Thank you.
Just because a lot of people don't hear this big word, producer, executive producer, showrunner. Like, you are a TV writer, so I want to be very clear that you write, you create shows, and you've done some incredible work. But then you have these big titles that I don't know if people really understand that are crucial to the creation of a lot of shows we know and love. And I actually first, really found out about your work with The Last Ship, which was, I binged it very quickly. It was very sad when it was over. Which also is kind of pertinent towards what's happening right now. Ooh. A little bit too close. But for those at home who don't understand what this big word of executive producer and showrunner are, can you give us kind of an idea of what that means?
Yeah, one of the great things about television is it's really built on the writer's side. So it's built from the ground up, from the writing. And as you go along in your writing career, you probably start as a staff writer and then you work up to a bunch of different levels. But eventually you reach a producer level, which is that individual who has written the episode is probably going onto the set and having some input into everything from wardrobe to props to whatever happens to be. They're more present on the production side. So as you rise through that, you just get more and more responsibility and jobs. So it extends into pre-production and on into post-production, and then you're hiring people and you have a big say in the casting, and then you're really dealing with both the networks and the studio. So by the time you get to executive producer or showrunner, you're talking to many, many more people. You're managing more people. Like what I say to people, the health and welfare of the entire show, your responsibility. So Whereas with a staff writer, you're only worried about scripts.
Yeah, you're in the writer's room. So it's like you get plucked from the writer's room and then you have to talk to people. That is...
pages, that stuff went away. And then, but my job is to manage everything from dealing with publicity all the way down to, is that script ready? Are those stories right? The network's not happy with that cut or whatever it happens to be. So showrunner is really top of the food chain. And tons of responsibility for the show, for the direction of the show, but also the management of the people.
And what I love about that is just because you're the showrunner doesn't mean that you aren't writing episodes. And I think like a lot of people, and it's always fun to me because I people like me watch the credits like in the beginning and we're like,
thank you.
Written by, but isn't he the, and you realize it is so consuming. Like it's so comprehensive from beginning to end. Did you know that this was what you wanted to do when you were like, I'm going to write for TV. Like, this is what I'm going to do.
No, I think that in the beginning, I mean, my transition really was from TV movies and from features, which is a very solitary kind of writing experience. And so when I transitioned to television on Flash Forward, I was more interested in that point with the collaborative nature of being in a writer's room and lots of writers pitching in the story and helping and all that. So I was like, wow, I should have gotten here a lot sooner. Because I, you know, like when you're writing features or when you're writing on your own, you're doing all the lifting yourself. And in the writer's room, you got a ton of smart people to help you. So I was like, wow, this is much better. And then as I began to see that the creative direction of the show is really driven by the showrunner, then I was like, yeah, I want that job. You know, because I want to be able to kind of steer the ship. I want to tell the stories that I want to tell. And so I'm going to work my way in that direction because that's ultimately, you know, what I want to have a larger say in. And, you know, it took some time, but you should train your way up to that. One of the great things about television writing is that it actually is an apprentice program, meaning you start on a certain level of the ladder and then you earn or you learn your way up. And if you do it correctly, best showrunners have been in TV for a while and they started as staff writers and they really learned it all the way to the top. So I happen to like that.
And I love that idea. And we've talked to a couple of folks that are in writers' rooms right now. And for folks who aren't familiar, like writers' rooms vary, but they are rooms where there are writers and they come together and they go through scripts and they dissect these things. How have you seen folks, because I know that some shows are still, like some writers' rooms are still happening.
Yes.
Right now, how have you seen that shift and what has kind of been the adjustment of that writer's room process while people are social distancing right now?
Well, two things kind of happened. One is over the past couple of years, writer's rooms have been getting smaller. Mm. Like when I started on Flash Forward, I think there were 12 writers in that room. Now we were doing 24 episodes. Like that was broadcast TV. But what has happened is there are now fewer and fewer writers in a room. Mm-hmm. So that was already happening. Mm-hmm. And then this move to kind of Zoom rooms or, you know, virtual rooms or whatever means that it's even harder to manage all those voices because it's five boxes on your TV screen or whatever. So people are, I think the amount of time spent in even the virtual room is getting smaller. Mm-hmm. And I think what I'm seeing a little bit right now is more of what happens in British television where a showrunner has got an overall idea and then gives certain people things to do, whether it's an episode or particular pieces of work to do. And it's piecemealed out. And then that showrunner is bringing stuff back together on an individual basis with a writer, because that's just easier to manage this way, where it's just one box that I'm talking to as opposed to six or seven.
Yeah.
But I think what's going to happen over the next 4 or 5 weeks, as things, at least in California, start to lighten up a little bit, I think there are going to be protocols put in place and people are going to come back to rooms. Yeah. Because there's an energy that happens inside a room when things are really cooking that just really can't be duplicated here. And that there's a certain something that's missing. And this is particularly around jokes. You know, like there's a vibe that goes on when smart people are together that can't be duplicated virtually. So we'll do the best we can right now, but certainly there's not going to be any replacing that energy digitally. So I think we're headed back to being in a room with the smart people.
And I think that actually brings up a really good question. A lot of folks who have these favorite TV shows, because let's be real, anybody right now who's got any free time, who is, you know, socially distancing, is consuming a lot of television or books. There's a lot of binge watching happening.
Yeah.
For you, and I think I have like a couple separate questions when we talk about shows that are made to binge that are all dropped at the same time, because you've done both. You've done appointment TV and we've just dropped all 13 episodes type TV. You know, for you, once there is a show idea and it's kind of out there, what is, and it kind of, you know, there's the pilot, like that's the simple answer, like that's the next step. But once there's a show idea and the pilot is greenlit, which we know is such a crucial and hard task to kind of put together, where do you then start, you know, with the next phase and with the writer's room and how that works normally?
Yeah, basically what happens is even when a creator is selling a show, he or she will have to lay out what season one, the general arc of season one, the spine, like this is where we're going. And I think at the end of season one, here's the big cliffhanger. So it's like a roadmap. So they've set up some things that they want to hit that they sold to the network.
Yeah.
Now, those things obviously change and so forth and so on, but they come into the room with those things. So that's absolutely the first thing that happens, is that you usually put up on the board somewhere, on the whiteboard that you use, by episode 5, we want to be here. By episode 6, we want to be here, and, you know, finale here. So that stuff goes off. Now, rarely does the showrunner or the creator know how he or she is getting from here to there.
I mean, not everybody's Babylon 5 and has a full Bible for the entire,
Yeah, it just doesn't work that way. So, for instance, when you talk about The Last Ship, those guys definitely knew where they wanted to end season one.
Yeah.
And they had some ideas for some places that they wanted to be, some certain ideas. And then the room came in and it's up to those people to go, well, here's the best way I think we can get from here to here to here. And now all you're doing is you're laying out like the Waze version of how to get from your point A to point B. And that's really the work of the room. And also to be open to changing those things if you come up with a better idea, which is mostly what happens. So a lot of things, like I put up on Instagram or Facebook or somewhere not too long ago, the season 3 board for Runaways that existed like in the first couple of weeks. And I think, you know, we only did 10 episodes in season 3, so there are 13 slots still up there. So we were still working with 13 stories. There was a whole section of what we call 3 men and a baby, which were going to be the dads building Victor Mancha, which obviously never got into the show.
Sorry, I'm so excited right now because you said Victor Mancha.
Exactly. So that was, and that really, like, that existed for a long, long time. And even after we got cut back to 10 episodes, we were like, well, how can we get this in? And ultimately, it just, spoilers for people who haven't seen it, but it ended up just being a note, right? Like, there's a note in the very end that Alex gets from his future self that name checks Victor. But but that's a perfect example. Hold on just a sec.
Ah, the beauty of the outside.
I know. Woohoo! We're in Southern California where gardeners are still working.
I don't know about it, but I'm glad that people are working when they can.
Me too. Good for them. So that's a good example of people going, oh, we have a great idea. We really carried it as far as we could. Then for lots of other reasons, that piece had to be dropped.
Yeah.
New stories had to be put in its place. But we worked for weeks and weeks and weeks on that with the assumption that Victor Mancha would be introduced in the show. And then, like I said, so you're constantly adjusting as you go.
Yeah.
But those first few weeks are really about making a roadmap that we will then follow and break episodes. So once that roadmap is in place, then we start back. Episode one, what is that about? We break that. Episode two, what's that about? We break that, and we go forward like that. And then writers are given those episodes, and then they leave the room to write them while everybody else proceeds down the path.
And they kind of know, and I love it because there's an assumption that they know the point A and the point B. They know where their episode is supposed to start, and they know where it is supposed to end and how they're supposed to get the baton to the next episode. You know, for you, are you still writing? Are you still writing right now? Are you doing writing rooms?
Yes. I mean, I would say that I'm super lucky. Writers in this scenario are super lucky because obviously they can work remotely, and studios and networks really felt like, and rightly so, that this was an opportunity to get a lot of stuff done ahead of time and have it prepped for when production can then begin. Whereas normally you might be writing and producing and doing all this stuff at the same time. And that's can be really difficult. That's a lot of work happening all at once. So studios and networks were very much like, well, let's get ahead, right? When nothing else is going on, let's just pay attention to scripts and to new material and development. And that's very much been my experience over the past few weeks.
And I love that because we've talked a lot. We've talked to a lot of actors. We talked to a couple of directors. And I really wanted to talk to, and we've talked to a couple of folks who are in writer's rooms. Mm-hmm. It's not their full time. That's not what they do all the time. But they are in several different writer's rooms with animation and live action. And it's interesting because you'll hear people go, yeah, I get pages that day. And it's like you forget those pages come from someone. And they were written and they were adjusted because of the things you're kind of talking about, whether or not something had to be pulled or added, or the director or the showrunner felt like there needed to be an adjustment. And I love kind of thinking about what does it mean to have all of this stuff ready?
Yes.
It's interesting.
You know, my real first experience with that was on 11/22/63, which was built in a way specifically for this, meaning they knew ahead of time that they were going to finish all the writing before they did any production. Mm. Now, why that decision was made, I'm not entirely sure. That was before I came on, but they, from the very beginning, that meant the showrunner and all the writers would be in the room the entire time, that all the scripts would be finished, and then they would just be delivered to the production. Now, part of that had to do with the scale of the show, meaning we were going to stage the Kennedy assassination, and that was a huge thing. And all of that. But it was very luxurious from a writer's point of view because there was no real ticking clock going like, hey, we're going to be finished by Friday, which is normally TV.
Yeah.
Like there's always you in TV, you're always playing against the clock. Whereas in features, you're rarely playing against the clock.
Hmm.
And so 11/22/63 was the first time that had really happened. And then on the first season of, The Last Ship was the same way. So both of those, and those jobs happened back to back. And I was like, well, I guess maybe this is kind of what we're doing. It hasn't proven to be the case, but it was interesting that the writing process for the people in the room was much more stress-free.
Mm.
It just seemed like you had time to work through ideas and make sure everything was right. And there it was just much more wiggle room. Whereas normally you're just like, boom, we got to get it done Friday, this thing, they got to have pages to shoot, like that's got to be VFX, blah, blah, blah. So it was interesting.
Which is interesting because when you think of a show like a Grey's Anatomy, and like we were talking to folks who, and we've had varied, we'd had people who were working on The Magicians and they're done, right? Like their finale happened. Were there things that they wish they would have done that would have been added? Maybe. Secure, done. They're in ADR, right? They got pages, but they're just doing ADR. They're not doing much. People are on the phone or there's other stuff happening. Whereas you have shows like The Flash or Grey's Anatomy or a lot of the CW shows right now who are like, we'll show shows until we're done showing shows because we were still in production, even though the episodes were going out. And so it's really interesting because I think a lot of folks see the Netflix model or the Hulu model, depending on what the show is. Marvel's Runaways being completely different than, let's say, Handmaid's Tale, which became appointment TV. And they were done. Like, they were finished. Like, they were wrapped up. They were ready to go. The post was done. And they were out. And it's just so interesting seeing and remembering that there are different methods. Do you think that changes based on the genre of TV show, or is that just like a choice of the showrunner or the network on how that process all happens?
It really is a choice. It still seems to be a big, I would say there's a lot of different theories still floating around about what's best. So it's not like that argument is, and I don't, maybe it'll never be resolved. So it is happening on a case by case basis where people are going, well, I think what's best for my show is this. And I think that one of the things that Netflix, I think the argument's probably over at Netflix. I think Netflix has said, or believes that their big selling point is the fact that if you come to Netflix, you can watch the show at your own pace. And that's the point. That's the reason you came to Netflix. And we leave that choice to you, and you watch it once a week or you watch it over a whole weekend. That's how we got your money. Hulu, that conversation has not been resolved. So
it depends on the show.
Yeah, case by case basis. We're going to drop three and then we're going to drop one at a time or whatever it happens to be. And that seems to be also Apple's approach, case by case. And I think there's probably you're going to see that now. Like I've got some friends working on Council of Dads, which they had a little teaser earlier in the season. And then I think tomorrow night they're going to show the pilot in the next episode. And then they'll go to the weekly thing. So
it's the Wild West right now with all the streaming services.
Absolutely. And so everybody's trying to respond. And I think that younger viewers value ownership. They do want to be in charge of how they watch it. So streamers or networks go, well, if we want that audience, if we want younger viewers, we're going to have to put this in their hands. And then the CW would say, well, no. I mean, we only give them one episode of Riverdale a week and they stick around. So like I said, it's nobody knows.
And I think that's actually kind of the beauty of it, is that no one does know, and it gives this opportunity for a show to be good. Because I remember there used to be great shows that just, they got a horrible time slot, or it was just on the worst day, or the competition was really crazy. And that's just something that you really don't deal with anymore, right? So like even in watching a Westworld or an Insecure, you know, Game of Thrones being Game of Thrones almost breaks the streaming of what was happening. It was a phenomenon. But most of the time I'm like, oh yeah, I'm going to catch up with tomorrow morning at, you know, 9 a.m. while I'm drinking my coffee. And it's just a different concept than going, well, if I'm not sitting down at 7 o'clock on a Friday watching TGIF, I'm going to miss it. And I don't know when the reruns are happening, if ever.
I think people can catch up. And again, it's what you hear from these guys when you go in to meet with them and when you talk to them about creating shows, wherever it happens to be, whether it's Hulu or Netflix or FX or wherever you are. They're really talking more about their library than they are about what's happening on the day and date. So they're looking to fill, and HBO Max and some of these others, the Peacock will be the best example. They're looking to fill libraries for people to watch after they finished the A-list thing that they signed up for.
It's archival, like we were kind of talking about, right? Because when they're done, there's this now this idea of an algorithm of recommendation. And then you get this list of, if you like this, you'll love this.
No doubt about it. And I would say that has proven to be the case when Runaways moved to Disney Plus. Mm-hmm. So there was a whole level of viewer who was interested in Runaways, but couldn't talk their parents or couldn't find the money to buy Hulu. Like there was not a strong enough buy reason for Hulu, but there was a huge buy for Disney Plus, right? So Marvel movies, you know, Pinocchio, whatever, like people could see the value and be like, okay, we're buying that. Then they came on like, oh, and Runaways is here too. So again, my social media feed, my email, like everything just blew up as soon as we hit Disney Plus, because there's a whole group of people who had been interested but didn't have the money to buy. And now they were all in. And that was months and months after the show was over. So now I had a completely brand new life. And that was rewarding. I was super happy about that.
That's pretty amazing, because that also is kind of that idea of appointment and missing it in a very different way, because you missed it just because it was behind a paywall, not because you couldn't watch it. So for you right now, you are still writing, you're still being creative, but you're not, I want to go back to this beginning statement of you're not in that room, there's not that energy, and your calm demeanor may be mistaken, but I do know that is, I can see it in your eyes that it's something that you really, really love.
Yes.
How have you been kind of adjusting and figuring out ways to keep that energy together? Because writing, regardless of how long you've been doing it, is sometimes, I don't want to say frustrating, but it's work. It is a thing to put together something that is translatable for someone else. So how have you been kind of creatively adjusting?
Well, one of the things that I've tried to do is really maintain some ritual, meaning that I have a whole kind of, because I've been at this long enough, I know my rhythm pretty well. Like I know what the sweet spot of the day is for me. I know what the run up, like what needs to happen in order for me to be really productive in that moment. So I try and duplicate all of those things. So if normally I'm at the writing table between 8 and 9 o'clock, whether I was in a room or I'm at home, I'm trying to be consistent so that the day actually feels like the way it used to feel. I may not be in that other location and I may not be with other writers in the room, but the day is pretty consistent with the way in which it unfolds. So that gives me a sense of security in a really insecure, larger context. Like we wake up every day and we don't know what the new news is going to be or what's going to be happening. And that's discombobulating. So if at the center of that, I can create consistency, this pretty much feels the way it used to feel in terms of how I'm spending my hours, then I get real comfort and I feel centered and my creative mind can work the same way. Now, the energy that I feed off from other people now has to be done through things like this, through texting back and forth with other writers who I'm helping or in contact with. I'm doing a lot of Zoom calls. There's a lot of actual business that's getting done now electronically this way. So all of keeping that energy up, so that now the weekend still feels like the weekend, so that I stop that work over the weekend.
Yeah.
And it gives a sense of familiarity that I personally need. I'm not a big chaos person. You mentioned the calm demeanor. So I'm not a big, I don't really vibe off of just fireworks going off and it's crazy here every day. Like that's not me.
No, not you.
No, not me. So me creating that consistency over time, my brain, my creative brain is like, okay, this is just like it always is. We're going to do the thing now that we normally do. We're doing it in the bedroom as opposed to in the writer's room, but we're still doing the same thing. And I found that to be really important in terms of generating pages and ideas and whatever it is that I'm working on.
Yeah. Actually, like deep down inside, the only thing I'm really sad is that you can't go to Disneyland. Like that deep down inside, like I just feel really, for those who don't know, your Disney fandom is.
It's a sickness. Yeah. No, but I'm really like, I'm the crazy guy who went on YouTube and found that 12-hour audio loop that somebody walked through the park. I don't know how they did it. But it's 12 hours of just ambient noise of being in Disneyland. And man, I run that in the background all the time. That's like music for me. It goes on and on and on. And again, it's another thing where I go like, I can feel like the endorphins and I can feel like my whole body go like, it's going to be all right. So that's how crazy it is around here.
But I love that you do have this very expansive knowledge, one. But this core love, like you don't just love doing what you do, you love the subject matter of what you do. And it takes that kind of passion. You're also a big comic book head and you don't just write TV shows.
Yes.
You have dabbled in the comic book industry as well. Talk to me a little bit of why you decided, like you could have just stayed a fan, but you were like, I'm going to write this.
No, I mean, the thing for me really was, and I tell people this all the time, and I'm sure you've heard me say it in the past, like as a kid, I wanted to grow up and be Jack Kirby. Like that was just it for me. Like I thought that guy was the pinnacle, and that really drove me for a long time. And Jack has really been kind of a centering thing for me, like that super creative imagination that just didn't have any boundaries. And just continue to work and work and work and work and work. So he's always been a guiding light for me. And so as a kid, and certainly as a younger person, I was like, man, I'm getting into comics. Like, that's what I'm going to do. Now, that went away as I became more. I went to art school and thought I was going to be a painter, really thought I was headed towards the fine arts. So I pursued that for a while before turning to writing. But I never got rid of that bug that at some point I would hopefully get an opportunity to make comics. And then just about a year and a half ago, maybe it's been 2 years now, I was approached by the French publisher Humanoids. Mm-hmm. And they said, you want to do something? And I said, oh, yeah, I do. And I had a story that they approved and I wanted to do a crime story. And that ended up becoming The Big Country, which is the graphic novel that that they published in November. So, yeah, it was a childhood dream come true, and I loved every minute of it. And, it's been a great, great experience, just as good as I hoped it would be when I was a kid.
So in all of that and, like, understanding that you are just such a pure creative, how are you staying creative? Like, I know you've got this process. I know you're going through it. And that's the process part. But is it just all Disneyland ambient noise all day? Is it like, I got to take a break and push away when I've got to push away?
I've got a pretty well oiled kind of mentality around output and input. Hmm. So I'm not afraid to say I'm in an input area, which is then I'm just doing tons of reading. I'm just totally tuned to the outside world, like looking at what's going around, really thinking deeply about what kind of stories energize me, what's cool, what's on my mind all the time, kind of a mental inventory. And so I have to be very honest with myself about this is an input day. This is not an output day. And try and be true to what's actually going on in the moment. Like when you're working, you don't get that luxury all the time. Like every day is an output day. So stuff's got to go and you just push through that. But in times like this, I try and be more sensitive to, all right, this is an input day. This is actually still work. This is what I do for a living. I use the phrase all the time. I don't get paid to type. I get paid to stare out the window. And so understanding that that's how it works, meaning I need this stuff to come in. Like if I showed you the reading desk right now, like there's tons of books on it. There's old Star Wars comics. It's like, for whatever reason at the moment, the like Marvel Star Wars comics from the 70s are kind of making their way back into my reading list. And I'm not entirely sure why, but it's tripping me right now. Like I'm just into it. So it's like, I don't need to know why. I just need to know that it's filling something in me at the moment and go, I'll know when I've had enough ice cream. Like I can stop, but right now it's just Star Wars comics. So I'm relaxed around that.
Nice.
And like I said, I let it be day by day. Like this is an output day. This is an input day. And I don't judge whether that's right or wrong. Just it is what it is. And I know the day is coming when I'll have to be many, many, many output days in a row. So if today is an input day, that there's no harm or no foul around that.
I love that. I also think that's like a really, really good piece of advice for folks who are, you know, struggling with this idea. And it's kind of been a common thread throughout all of the conversations. Today and tomorrow and the next few weeks may not be your time to write the next great American novel. And it is okay. Because there is this, I think we have lost the idea of inspiration most times it is sparked externally, right? Mm-hmm. Like you may have the story inside of you, but a lot of times it's all based on our experience, where we've been, you know, people we've met. Like when you look at things like The Office, right? It's based on real things that happen at offices. And so life has to happen at some point to be able to be inspired or be creative. And so I think that's such an interesting perspective about input and output days, because I don't know if we've all had, and I don't even say the luxury, I don't know if we've all been, you know, had the awareness to take that step back and go, I'm just going to go read a book. Maybe one I've read before, find something new in it and be inspired. What are you doing for fun?
Well, I'm like Duke Ellington on this one, which is, you know, Duke Ellington said, I don't really have a job, meaning I love what I do so much that there is no, I don't need to take a vacation. So I've been super blessed to get into a spot where actually reading Star Wars comics is part of my job and part of what I do. So as much as, obviously have things like we're doing a jigsaw puzzle like everybody else in America. I got this Charlie Brown jigsaw puzzle going on that is the most intense thing. Like I'm going to have to put it away. Like it's just beating me. But like we've got lots of that stuff around the house. But in terms of fun, like my life is fun. So I'm full of those kinds of things as a regular part of my life. And it's not really separate from my work. So I'm going to start. I just ordered the Doctor Who box set thing, the Matt Smith years. Like I'm going to watch that thing from top to bottom. So there'll be lots of that stuff.
I just got really excited for you.
Yeah. And that's what you mean. Like I already watched all those live at the same time. It's not like I don't know them. But I feel like right now I want to be there. So I don't think too much about why that is. Maybe it's a little familiarity. And I love those years. I love those episodes so much. So I'll just go over there and spend that time with that stuff.
Yeah, so, between David Tennant and Matt Smith, I will honestly say, and you can at me on this, folks who are watching, the action-packedness of both those actors' ability to be so physical, like their literal physicality in executing those scripts, it's just phenomenal, because it was just a whole, it was a whole shift in how Doctor Who was presented and in the modernization of the show. That makes it so much fun to watch.
No question about it. And I was really like, you know, before you hit the send button on Amazon or whatever, I'm like, okay, so these are kind of streaming here and there. Do I want to own these? And then you go, yes, actually I do. I want to be in possession of this so that any moment, if I want to go and watch the opening of the Pandorica or any of those things that I want, I can just pull it up and it's there. That's how good all of that work is. That David Tennant to the Matt Smith run is, it's just classic, and there's no reason to not be in full ownership of it.
Yeah, so. And it's so funny, like both those actors, I've interviewed them both, and David literally is that person. Like he's just physically, if you've ever met, like he's just physically, he was explaining to me how someone on set had basically like broken his nose and he couldn't just tell the story.
Oh, no.
He had to actually act out the story, and then you, it clicks, it goes, oh, that's just you. That's
it
you
is
on screen. Uh-huh. Okay. And then you realize that, you know, Matt Smith was a footballer before he couldn't, you know, play anymore. And you're like, oh, that's just, you brought yourself to the screen. So they are so much fun to watch. And I love it because, you know, it's the same thing where people are like, well, if you want to learn how to do something, you want to be inspired how to do something, or if you do a thing, watching other people do the thing isn't a bad thing.
No,
I mean, not a bad thing, but that's fine. So in and of itself, kind of as we close out, I want to say, like, you also did a series for screenwriting that is now available on your YouTube, which is really cool. What inspired you to decide that you were going to take the class that you normally do teach UCLA?
Yep.
What made you decide to do that?
Well, obviously the circumstance was the first thing, but I have been feeling quite a bit lately, and I mentioned it earlier, that I've really been blessed with an extraordinary life there by any measure. And that the point of my being blessed with that life is actually to give it away. So the only reason that I've been given this thing is so that I could give it away. And at this particular moment, it felt like the right time to give that away so that those people who were feeling like, I'll never be able to afford to go to this class, I'll never be able to work with people like this, blah, 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 that those barriers would be lowered. And that I would just give that thing away to anybody anywhere who could get on YouTube and go through it and wanted to spend this time in quarantine actually jump starting something and making it, that I could really be an encourager there, give them both some tools, but also encourage them to go, hey, if you really want to do it, you just got to sit down and get started. And like I said, I didn't want that to cost anything. So whereas normally, obviously, if I'm teaching at UCLA, that's a tuition thing and all of that. So I just felt like this was the perfect time to give that away. And the technology, and as you said, everybody's on their screens anyway. Might as well be watching this as opposed to another episode of Fuller House, if that's what they want to do.
I mean, Fuller House, man. Talk about reboots. Again, created because someone recommended Full House and people started an uptick.
That's right.
I predict a lot of reboots happening after this quarantine.
Well, I think one of the things that happened that surprised people, I mean, I know I was surprised, was how the ratings for regular broadcast TV shot through the roof. And there was literally no reason for that to happen, except that people wanted that familiar experience. So it wasn't like TV, broadcast TV got better and people like, hey, this is actually better than I thought. It's still the same thing it always was. And they went, oh, you know, I kind of like the way this feels. And when the commercials come on, it doesn't bother me as much as I thought it would. So I'm just going to stick around. And that's that sense of familiarity that I think you're right. You're going to see a lot of like, oh, remember how good this used to feel? And believe me, I think that's coming.
Yeah. And it's really interesting how all of this is connected. For those who should be following you, who aren't following you yet, but also so they can check out the YouTube, can you let everybody know where to find you and all your stuff?
Yeah, I think if you go on YouTube and you just enter my name, it will take you right. Yep, there it is. it'll take you right there, and you'll see all 10 videos in a row. We've classified them by day. So if you want to follow along, you can. You can jump around if you're not into that. But they do follow from starting a project all the way through revision. The very last episode is really about the life of a screenwriter, agents, managers, all of that part. So if you follow chronologically, there is a purpose to that. And then I think one of the students started a Facebook page where people who have questions and want to have a further discussion are logging onto that Facebook page, talking to each other. And then I drop in occasionally to answer a question or help out. And I think that's under, I think the Facebook page is Writing with Quentin. So yeah, both Facebook and YouTube, and it's there for you if you dig it.
I love it. Thank you so very much for like taking the time out. This has been great.
Well, thank you. I'm a huge fan and I love everything that you do and everywhere you do it. So it was really an honor for me to be asked. So I appreciate it.
Thank you. So thank you so much, everybody. If you want to follow Quentin, please do. It's and go binge all the shows he's ever touched, please, like now. I actually started re-binging The Last Ship. I'm not going to lie.
Yeah. Now's the time, let me tell you.
Creative Quarantine is hosted by Angelique Roche. It's produced by Angelique Roche, Sarah Storm, and Matt Storm. Our logo is designed by Aaron Leffler. New streaming episodes are available Monday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday at 3 p.m. Eastern and Tuesdays at 2 p.m. Eastern on AngeliqueRoche.com/creativequarantine. Podcasts are made available the morning after each live streamed episode wherever you get your podcasts. Please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and visit us on Instagram at creative.quarantine and Twitter at creativeqtine. Please send this to a friend who needs a little artistic company and stay at home if you possibly can. We'll see you soon.
Hey, it's Leslie Odom Jr. here on the Broadway Podcast Network to tell you about the RISE Theater Directory, a program of Maestro Music. RISE is a national online resource designed to connect and empower backstage and administrative and creative theater professionals from underrepresented backgrounds. If you work or aspire to work in the theater community, this can help you find your next project. And if you hire theater professionals, search the RISE Theater Directory to find your next team. Create your profile now and get more information by visiting risetheater.org. That's theater with an RISETHEATRE.org. Because only together we rise.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.